are very kind. All right. I really am having trouble with my computer. If you had a chance to speak to 5,000 people about what you thought was important, what would you say? A lot of people would say, let me lay out for you the entire gospel message. From the beginning to the end, and then ask you to make a decision about whether you should follow Jesus or not. And that has changed the lives of many people. I'm not going to knock that as an option. I'm just having trouble getting this to play. Oh, wait, now it went. Now we're good. Okay. Something about what you said. All right. So that wouldn't be a bad way to go, but it's an interesting point that when Jesus had a chance to speak to 5,000 people, first he fed them, and then he said, a sower went to sow some seed. Some of the seed fell here on the path, and the birds came and ate it up. Some of the seed fell in the rocky soil, and it grew up quickly, and it dissipated because of lack of moisture. And some of it fell in the weeds, and the weeds grew up and choked it out. And some of it fell on the good soil, and that produced a crop, 30, 60, 100 fold. That's what he said to them. And then you know what he said? Bye. And he walked away. If you go and read in Mark 4, the next sentence after that is, later on, the disciples asked him, dude, well, maybe not dude. They said, well, huh? What was all that about? And he kind of chides them. Have you read it? Do you remember it? He kind of says, if you didn't understand that, how are you going to understand any of the parables? He expected them to be able to unpack that parable. And they couldn't do it. And so he explained it to them. The seed is the word of God, and some of it fell here, and so on and so on. You know the whole story. But what I find interesting for our purposes when we're talking about beauty and how it is that God reveals himself in language and reveals himself to us in revelation, how he reveals himself to us. It's interesting to me that he expected us to exercise our imaginations. And it dawns on me that your imagination is a gift from God. It's a gift that he gave you in order to do a specific thing, and that was to be able to unpack metaphors. To unpack, to think through, to see through, to imagine the connections that are metaphoric. Human beings do that, don't we? We sense beauty in things. We sense wisdom in things. You don't see a grizzly bear sitting on the side of the Grand Canyon going, wow. They just don't pay any attention to it. They're very literal. But we're more than literal. We can look at the Grand Canyon and sense awe, A-W-E, can't we? And there's something about it metaphorically that touches us. The beauty of a sunset. The beauty of a piece of music. They touch us somehow, but they come to us through our imaginations. Now, a lot of people get nervous about Christians using their imaginations, and for good reason, because if you let your imagination just run wild, you can imagine all sorts of crazy things. You can interpret the Bible very strangely. So I'm not talking about just free reign imagination. I'm talking about what you might call a baptized imagination. An imagination that assumes that God is in charge, that assumes that there's a revelation there to be understood, and within the context of that revelation and connecting it up with all the other bits of revelation we get, we find out something new. And my point here is, our imaginations are supposed to be exercised in order to be able to see metaphoric relationships between things. I mentioned in the last talk that God reveals himself to us metaphorically all the time. In fact, only, it's exclusively that way. When he describes himself in metaphoric terms. We can't understand him any other way. He tells us he's a king. He tells us he's a master. He tells us he's a brother. He tells us he's a friend. He tells us he's a, one of the Psalms has him being like a mother hen gathering her chicks. Jesus speaks about that. I long to be able to gather you together like a hen gathers her chicks. Well, that's the way to understand it. When there's a story that Beethoven played through a sonata of his in a concert one time. And afterwards, somebody came up to him and said, "Hey, Ludwig, what did it mean? What did your piece mean?" And he stumbled around trying to find words to describe it. And he couldn't find the right words. He just sat down and played the whole thing again. Why? Because that was the way to say it. The thing he was trying to say could only be expressed that way. Same kind of story. T.S. Eliot, one time, great poet, 20th century poet, read one of his poems to an audience. And if you've read any Eliot, you know it's pretty dense stuff. And afterwards, someone inevitably came up to him and said, "Tom, what's it mean? What are you trying to say?" And I wish I could be this quick, but what he said back to him was, "You mean you want me to say it worse? Do you see?" He worked and worked and worked to get every syllable of that poem to hit just at the right moment, with the right rhymes, with the right rhythm, the right order, the right tempo, you know, of each idea. And so the poem was the way to say the thing he was trying to say. Well, if you want me to boil it down to a bottom line, I'll do damage to the thing I'm trying to say. That's what he was saying. That's what art is, and that's how metaphors work. Because metaphors participate with the thing they're trying to say. I was talking at lunch with one of you, and I mentioned one of Eliot's poems, The Wasteland. It's called Wasteland. If you haven't read it, you need to read it. It's a dark poem. It's not a very pleasant poem, but it's profound in the sense that it describes the world between the two wars, as the French say, l'entre-deux-guerres, between World War I and World War II in France. And it was a very pessimistic time. Up until the First World War, people had been pretty optimistic about technology, about how things were going. But after the war, they saw that the technology that they had been touting all this time led to things like mustard gas and machine guns and horror in the trenches. And many, 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 many people died. And somehow the meaning was sucked out of the air in those couple of decades between 1918 and 1939. And Eliot wrote this poem, The Wasteland, in 1922. And it was before he became a Christian. He became a Christian in 1927, I think. Maybe it was 29. 27, I think. But anyway, it was before he became a Christian. But he was asking all the right questions in this poem. the sadness, the suffering, the difficulty of living in a world that was fragmented, that was broken apart, that no longer had a sense of meaning, order. And the poem is made up of a whole slew of different segments, little fragments of other people's writings. He borrowed from Shakespeare and from Dante and from Milton and from the Bhagavad Gita and from the Buddha and Chaucer. He was an extremely well-read fellow, Eliot. But what he did was he sewed together all these little fragments of all these great works that had made up the culture that was now crumbling and fragmented in his eyes. So you see, the form of the poem and the thing that he was trying to say, that is the content, the message of the poem, fit together perfectly. And that is an example of beauty. Beauty is when the object that you create participates in and opens your eyes to, by way of its shape, by way of its actual workings, opens your eyes to the thing that he's trying, that you're trying to get across. In this case, that the world is a fragmented and very difficult place to live in right now, with very little hope. Now, not to leave you with that kind of a poem, in the latter part of the 30s and into the 40s during the war, Eliot wrote maybe the best poem in the 20th century called The Four Quartets. And it's an altogether different piece where he answers the questions that he raised, I think, in the wasteland. So you've got some fun reading ahead of you. And the answer he gives is Christian. But that's an example of how it is that the form of a piece of work and the thing it's trying to get across have to match up. And when they do, that's when the sparks fly. That's when the beauty is seen and experienced. So I said to you in the last hour that education was about the ordo amoris, and it was about the medieval synthesis being a good example of how to get that ordo amoris across. The ordo amoris, you remember, is the ordering of your loves, to attune, as it were, your heart to love the things that are worth loving to the degree that they're worth loving. And the medieval synthesis was an opportunity to see the combination of the material world and the spiritual world together. I was thinking about this when I closed the last session. At Chartres Cathedral, I just was telling you about Chartres. At Chartres Cathedral, there are a lot of uses of number in the building. You'll see things in threes. For example, there were three portals, you know, at the west end. Well, there are three portals on the north side and there are three portals on the south side, which means three threes. Three was the number that the medievals thought represented the spiritual, the Trinity, for example. Four was the number that represented the material, the four elements, for example. And so you see all through Chartres Cathedral combinations of threes and fours. You'll see three by themselves, you see four by themselves. You also see sevens, which is the combination of the two, right? Seven liberal arts, for example. But also you'll see twelves. Twelves are the multiple of three and four, right? So you'll see 12 disciples. You'll see 12 tribes of Israel. And in the north rose window, you see combinations of circles and squares, and circles and squares. The circle represents the eternal, the unending eternal. And the square represents, as I said, the four sides of the material world. And it goes back and forth and back and forth between them in the same window. And they're showing you, by way of numbers, this idea of combination of the spiritual and the physical together. We usually don't think this way now when we build churches, but it would be a good idea to start thinking, I think, again that way, because it represents things to us that we can't represent in didactic ways. In fact, if you think about the Bible, I heard somebody say one time, these percentages may be a little off, but somebody said one time that 75 or 80% of the Bible is written in artistic form, that is, parables and history, stories and metaphors and all that kind of thing, poems, and only 20% or 15% is didactic, that is, thou shalt not kill, you know, specific commands and direct communication like that. So when God speaks in his revelation, he chooses to speak in poetry. So it behooves us to learn how to read poetry. He speaks in parables. It behooves us to learn to imagine how to unpack parables and metaphors. Because if we're willing to give Beethoven and T.S. Eliot the benefit of the doubt and say they wrote or composed something that could only be explained or conveyed in that way, shouldn't we certainly give that kind of dignity to God? Because when God speaks, not only does his communication itself, the content is holy, but he is God, after all, and so any choice that he makes is going to be perfect. If we want to know something about the relationship between God and us, we can say he told us he's the vine and we're the branches. And we don't want to say, well, that's just one way to say it. You could say it a bunch of other ways. This is God's word we're talking about. Now we have to say this has authority in its form as well as in its content. The way to say it is also part of the communication. Tonight's lecture is going to be unpacking that in a speech from Hamlet, in a chapter from Job, and a bit of Brahms' Requiem. But for the moment, I want to say that there is a kind, we talked about the two kinds of revelation, special revelation, general revelation. There's a third kind of revelation. It's actually a kind of special revelation, so it's really a subset of special revelation, but it's the incarnation itself, or himself, I should say. God, when he wanted to convey who he really is to us, became flesh and dwelt among us. You know, at the beginning of that Gospel of John, where he says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. It was quoted this morning, I think. John, you know, was writing to the Greeks, to the Gentiles. And the word he used there for God was word, the word logos. Greek word for word, right? So in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God from the beginning. Well, when the Greeks heard that, they went, well, duh. We knew that. You can go back to Greek philosophers and find them talking about, Plato did this, the God. And he uses the word logos. So that wasn't the surprise to the Greeks, the opening salvo, as it were. But what was a surprise and what made them all run was about 12 verses later, where it says, and the Logos became flesh and dwelt among us. The Logos, in the Greek mind, was this all-encompassing power that held everything together, but it was at great distance. It was nowhere near a human being. In fact, the idea that the organizing power of the universe, the thing that held the stars in place, could become a person, that's crazy talk. So when John wrote, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, they all said, check, please, you know, I'm out of here. That's crazy talk. And I think that's one of the reasons that Paul says that the gospel is foolishness to the Greeks. It doesn't seem to make any sense in their worldview. You have to break free of that worldview before you can imagine. And it's the incarnation that breaks them free. And what I want to say is, the incarnation is God's greatest creation. He created himself, as it were, as a human being. And what it means to us is, he knew our weaknesses. He knew our capacities to be able to understand him. And so he spoke to us in parables, he spoke to us in history, he spoke to us in poetry. But in the end, as it says in Hebrews, in the end, he stopped sending just a prophet or just another book of the Bible. He sends his son, who embodies him completely. When Jesus spoke to his disciples, he said, "If you've seen me, you've seen the Father." "I and the Father are one," he said. I want to say this is the pattern for Christians to think about the arts, because it's our work to manifest in not literally the flesh, but in the material that God has given us, in stone, in sound, in film, in photograph, in poetry, in language, all the media that we have to create with. It's our job to shape that into such a way that it opens the eyes of the viewers to things that are beyond them. Like I said in the first session, there's no way in the world I could know God unless he reveals himself to me, and that's what he did. In two kinds of special revelation, one kind of general revelation. And those things embody the thing that I'm supposed to know. Well, we are made in the image of God. Now, we create because we're part of that image. He creates, so we create. It's part of who we are. Somebody used to say the definition of the human being was homo faber. We say homo sapien, that is, the one who knows. But homo faber is one who makes. We make things. We make chairs. We make air conditioning units. We make lights. We make pianos. We just do. And we don't have to be a Christian to do it. It's just part of who we are. It's like what we leave behind. The culture is what we leave behind. The culture is what we craft and hand on to the next generation. To people around us, and they pass it down to the next generation. It becomes the way that we say things. It becomes the way that we understand things. Metaphoric use of art. So, Jesus himself is the greatest metaphor that ever lived. And he opens our eyes to the truth. All right. This medieval synthesis, I think, is best embodied in Genesis 2:7. If you remember Genesis 2:7, it goes, God made man out of the dust of the earth and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living what? What does your translation say? Soul? Somebody said soul? Anybody have to have a different word? Creature, yeah, I've heard, seen that a lot. Anybody else? Being, yes, I've heard being too, that's right. The old version, you know, the King James version is soul. Isn't that interesting? When we think of a soul, we usually think of the invisible part of us, right? We have a body and we have a soul. Now, I'm not a theologian, but I've run this past some people who really are experts in the Hebrew language, and they tell me this is a legitimate translation of this 2:7. The dust of the earth is the material, the body. The thing that he breathes into the nostrils is the breath of God, the spirit, the pneuma in Greek. And it's the combination of that body and that spirit that makes the soul. So the soul is actually all of you, not just part of you. And I think it's important to see it that way because the Greeks are the ones in their dichotomous thinking that gave us that bifurcated notion of a body and a soul as though they were two separate things and combined together. It's really the body and the spirit that combine together to make one thing, and that one thing is the soul. It used to be that if a tragic airplane accident happened, the news would report 24 souls were lost. You ever heard that kind of reporting? They called the people on the plane souls. But they weren't talking about, they're talking in that, it's kind of an old-fashioned way of understanding soul. It's this way that the King James Version describes it. Think about it this way. We have basically two genres of horror movies. We have the horror movie that's called the zombie movie, and we have the movie that's called the ghost movie. The zombie movie is just the body without the spirit. And the ghost movie is the opposite, the spirit without the body. And both of them are uncanny. Both of them are frightening. Both of them are uncomfortable, right? If somebody said, there's a zombie on the other side of the stage who's about to come out here, it would make everybody's heart race a little more, right? Or if I said, there's a ghost in this room right now, you might wonder, what on earth, you know? But if you take the body and the spirit and you put them together, it's not frightening at all. It's just, you know, Bob. He's not frightening, you know. It's just him. He's just always here, you know. You look at him and you think, so? You know. Bob, I feel there's a Bob here. I know you're a great guy. I'm not trying to. But that's what we're up against. We think that there is an uncanny separation. And you know what God says about marriage? He says, what God has brought together, let no man put asunder. You know that in the wedding, old-fashioned wedding ceremony. And I think that's how it is with us too. Because we're meant to be together. That is body and spirit. We're meant to be a whole soul. And that is why it's very important theologically that we remember 1 Corinthians 15, which is all about the resurrection of the body. Because when we die, we're separated. Right? The body goes in the ground, the spirit returns to God, we're told in Ecclesiastes. But at the last judgment, all are going to be reunited in their bodies. And the reason we know that, of course, is that not only did Paul tell us about it, but Jesus lived it out. After the resurrection, he's flesh and blood of some kind. He can walk through doors. That's pretty impressive. But I always wondered, why is it that he asks, do you have anything to eat? Do you remember that? After the resurrection, he meets up with the disciples. Do you have anything to eat? Yeah, I got this fish here. Great. And he eats it in front of them. Now, why? Well, to show that he's not a ghost. He's a flesh and blood guy. Thomas says, I won't believe it till I can see the holes in his hands, my finger in the hole. What does he do? He says, here, take a look. Stick your whole hand in the hole. It's me. Well, there's got to be a hole there to be done to, right? I mean, so what I'm trying to say is, you're not supposed to be apart. This is why I think he wept over Jerusalem. This is why he wept, not Jerusalem so much, as at the tomb of Lazarus, I mean. This is why he was weeping. He looked at death, the death of his friend, and death completely, death on the grand scale. And he said, this is wrong. It's not supposed to be like this. I want to fix this. And it's the love of God that fixes it and brings us back together again. And so we'll live in eternity embodied. He's the firstborn of this new creation. All of this is to say how important it is that we manipulate material and use it for the glory of God. Whatever you're doing, whatever your hand finds to do, do it all to the glory of God, including writing poems, crafting music. But do it with your eyes on Him, you see. That's where the quality level will be the best. As soon as we take our eyes off of Him and start thinking we're going to mass produce this, or we're going to make a lot of money doing it, or whatever like that, suddenly the quality starts to deteriorate. Human beings need material references. The way to fix the decline of our culture is for Christians to create art. Does that sound crazy? I say that because right now we're not taken seriously. We don't create good art very often. We don't think it's important as Protestants, I think. We think that it's more important that we preach the gospel. And I want to say amen to that. Preach the gospel by all means. But one of the means is through the arts. And sometimes that mean is the one that really can make a difference in people's lives and get in under the radar when an apologetics argument directly might not. And we want... The way that we convey the gospel to the next generation has to be done at least in part through the arts. We make statues, we make music, we craft paintings, we tell stories. And that's how they're conveyed. That's how it's conveyed. We build churches. That's how we convey it. We choose music in our worship services. You ever think about how you're glorifying God with the music that you choose in your worship services? So the purpose of art is to make the invisible visible for another person. It's a means of communication. It's a language. It's a language in stone or whatever medium. Do you know what medium means, by the way? What does medium mean? Anybody know? Excellent. That's right. Air is the medium for sound, isn't it? That's a great, great example. That's right. Medium is the means by which something is communicated one to the next. If you go to the store and you see clothing and there's smalls here and there are larges there and in between they're mediums, in a sense, that's not really a size. Small is a size. Large is a size. Medium is in between the two. Do you see? That's how it's used. And when we say the media, that's just the plural of medium, isn't it? Well, the newscast that you get on the TV or the cable or whatever, the newscast on the radio, is a means by which you get to learn something about the thing that he's talking about. Often I'm afraid you can't trust them, but never mind, that's not the point. The point is, it requires the medium of television or the medium of radio or the medium of the language that they're using to get the point across in order to convey something one to another. And that's what I'm talking about. That's what the arts are for. And the way to do it is not to complain about the things that other people are doing as much as it's important to create your own and let it be better. Let it be stronger. Let it be more powerful. Let it crowd out all that secondary or weaker or two-dimensional art and say something profound. That's what we're up against. And I think you guys are going to have to take that on in your generation. The imagination, as I'm saying, has to be properly trained in order to unpack the things that that the arts say, the metaphors say. And so, I want to give you a couple of views of the imagination that came about in the 18th century that undermined the kind of medieval synthesis that we've been talking about. This is by no means a thorough description of the history of philosophy. There's lots of stuff that comes between the 14th century and the 18th century. You could track the whole the whole thing, and it would take 4 hours, 5 hours to even give you an outline. But what I want to do is jump to the 18th century and show you somebody who gave a picture, a different picture of the world. And the guy's name is Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Have you ever read any Rousseau? Anybody read Rousseau? What did you read? Can you name it? Social Contract. That's what most people read. That's right. Well, let me give you a little bit of the Social Contract to show you what it is that Rousseau was after. You have this famous quote. He opens the Social Contract with this: "Man is born free, but everywhere is in chains." And what he means by that is that man is born good, and that the institutions of the world put him into chains. The institutions in particular that he was against were the Catholic Church in France, and the aristocracy in France. And many people say that it's Rousseau and his ideas that brought about the French Revolution. Anybody know when the French Revolution was? All right. I'm so glad to hear you guys know your dates. 1789, the storming of the Bastille. And it went on for some 4, 5, 6 years, ending with, in 93 or so, with the beheading of Louis the 16th, and eventually his wife too, Marie Antoinette, and a bloody mess is what happened, eventually leading to Napoleon taking over, and because he was one of the revolutionaries, and eventually crowning himself emperor, which was a kind of anti-revolutionary thing to do, but never mind. Rousseau's idea was that you can explain the existence of evil in the world by saying it all comes from institutions. Evil is not in the heart of man. Evil is in the creations of these institutions that then dictate to man what he can and can't do. He's not free because the church tells him what to do. He's not free because the aristocrats abuse their power and the church abuses its power. In contrast with that, you have this fellow. There you go. Edmund Burke. And Edmund Burke wrote a book. Social Contract was written in, I think, 1762. Edmund Burke wrote a book called Reflections on the Revolution in France the year after it began, 1790. And in it, he argues for a different way of looking at the world, and that way of looking at it can be described as a moral imagination. Rousseau's idea was an idyllic imagination. Burke's idea was a moral imagination. Now, there are a lot of differences between the two, but the one I want to focus in on is this notion of where evil comes from. I told you that Rousseau said that man was born good. He was what they call a tabula rasa, a blank slate that then the institutions write on and cause all sorts of problems. Burke, on the other hand, had a Christian view of man, and he said the location of evil is in the heart of every man, that we're born sinful, and we can't get out of it ourselves. So we have to have help. Let me read you the quote. I'm going to skip over one and read you Burke's quote about the moral imagination. This comes from the Revolution in France book, Reflections on the Revolution in France. "All the decent drapery of life is to be rudely torn off." This is how the French Revolution addressed everything. "All the superadded ideas furnished from what he calls the wardrobe of a moral imagination, which the heart owns and the understanding ratifies as necessary to cover the defects of our naked, shivering nature and to raise it to dignity in our own estimation. All those things are to be exploded as a ridiculous, absurd, and antiquated fashion. On this scheme of things, a king is but a man, a queen is but a woman is but an animal, and not an animal of highest order even. All homage paid to the sex in general, as such, and without distinct views, is to be regarded as romance and folly. On the scheme of this barbarous philosophy, which is the offspring of cold hearts and muddy understandings, and which is as void of solid wisdom as is destitute of all taste and elegance, laws are to be supported only by their own terrors and by the concern which each individual may find in them from his own private speculations, or can spate to them from his own private interests. Nothing is more certain than that our manners, our civilization, and all the good things which are connected with manners and with civilization have depended for ages upon two principles. I mean the spirit of a gentleman and the spirit of religion. Now, if you're like me, you hear in that a lot of modern thought. That very same idea, set of ideas, I think is going on in our culture right now. We are told that all of the traditional understanding of gender, for example, traditional understanding of marriage, traditional understanding of sexuality in general, all those things are antiquated and useless and purpose to undermine them and get them out of the way so that we can have somehow direct contact with who we really are, and don't give us all that nonsense. But my point here is that it's the nonsense that is the thing. All this time I've been telling you that the right metaphor is the thing. That is the way that we can understand the thing we're talking about, you see? For God to describe himself as a vine or a king is a metaphor, but it's only in experimenting, or that's the wrong word, in exploring that metaphor that we begin to understand who he really is. That the kings and the vines of this world are the secondary imitations, the mirror images, the imitations of the real thing. But then we begin to realize that he's that and more. He's that and everything, all that and more, you see, and it opens our eyes to it. So the metaphor is the way that we get into the understanding that we're given of whatever it is we're talking about. And I want to argue that's how these super-added ideas, he calls them, the super-added ideas furnished from the wardrobe of a moral imagination. I'm going to come back to that word wardrobe in a minute. Those things are the way that we get the benefit of those things. Think of it this way. If you lay a fire in a fireplace and touch it off, the brick of the fireplace, the stone of the fireplace, and the recession of it, and the smoke flue, all combine together to make that fire safe. And it can provide light, it can provide warmth, it can cook food, it can be beautiful to look at. All the things that it's good that are good about fire can be appreciated. But if you were to take that same fire and drag it out of the firebox into the middle of the living room, well, conflagration, isn't that the right word? Everything would happen terribly badly. You set fire to your house. My point is, it's the fireplace that makes it possible for us to enjoy the fire. Do you see? Look at this bottle of water. It's possible for me to enjoy this bottle of water, to drink this water, but only because it's in the shape that it's in. It's inside this plastic form. I need the plastic form. If I were to say poof and make the plastic form disappear, the water would splash all over the floor, wouldn't it? And I couldn't drink any of it. In other words, it'd be useless to me now. It's because of the form that I'm able to grasp the benefits of the thing. Think of marriage. Think of how that's a system. It's a superadded idea. It's a traditional form. And it makes it possible for our sexual desires to be funneled in the right direction, to be used properly in the way that God intended. Think of that, those promises that we make at the altar when we marry, like the fireplace. They make a box around the fire of our sexual passions and desires and so on, that orders them, puts them in their proper place, makes it possible for us to truly enjoy them the way they're intended to be enjoyed. The French Revolution idea is to do away with all those superadded ideas, do away with all those intermediate steps, those media that come between us and the thing that we want. I say, I don't want to wait for marriage. I want to sleep around now. Well, let's just get rid of marriage then. See? Well, let's throw marriage out. Now I can be directly in contact with whatever it is I want. I don't want the firebox. I just want the fire. Set the couch on fire. You see? Well, wait a minute. There's a reason why there's a firebox. There's a reason why there's a marriage. There's a reason why he said, till death do you part. It's because when you have that kind of trust in your marriage, you can be available to the other. You can be trusting. You can trust the other not to leave you. And it requires that kind of trust in order to be able to truly be married. So all I'm saying is that we always have to consider the form of things, not just the content. So this means that we have to take seriously our desires for worship. We have to think, how can I design the liturgy of our worship service to be the firebox around the joy of meeting God? How can I create a system, an organization that will make worship flow freely and safely and wholly? But it's that the French Revolution mindset, the idyllic imagination, wants to do away with in every case. Think of transgenderism. You've got somebody who says, I was born a man, but I'd like to be a woman. I'm going to put aside all of the problems with that that I'm very compassionate about. If somebody truly is confused about that, that's a great concern that we should be praying for and caring about, okay? But think about what it is that the solution is that these guys want to offer. What is it the idyllic imagination offers as a solution? Well, your body doesn't fit with your mind. The mind, the thing you want in your will and your sense of yourself is one thing, and your body is the other thing. So what should we do? Well, let's change your body. Let's just change your body. Why is the outward material world not fungible? It should be changeable. You should be able to either take hormones, do surgeries, whatever. In order to change the way your body works in order for you to be the thing you feel like you are. That's, as my dad used to say, bass ackward. It'll come to you later. It's the wrong way around. It used to be that people thought that there are fixed realities out there, God and the world that he's made, and wisdom would be for me to learn to live within the confines of God's design for me and the world that he's made. But the idyllic imagination says the world out there is flexible, and it may not even be true anyway. It's flexible. It can be changed. The thing that's unmovable is me. My will is the most important thing in the world. And my will says, I want to do something different, and so I'm going to change everything around me in order so that I can have that one thing. That's the idyllic imagination. It rips away all of the traditions. It rips away all of the foundations. It rips away all the, what he calls the moral imagination, the elements, the superadded ideas that are furnished by the wardrobe of the moral imagination. Now, we have to quit at 9:45, don't we? Is that right? Yes? Okay. Well, let me give you this one last thing then. What does Burke say is the way to gather that moral imagination, to convey it? Well, he calls it the wardrobe of a moral imagination. And later on, he talks about what that wardrobe is. And it's made up of poetry. It's poetry that's the wardrobe of the moral imagination. It's in poetry, and I use that word to cover all the arts, painting, music, theater. Those are the things that convey to us the humanity and the depth of appreciation of our humanity found in metaphors. Connecting our material lives with the spiritual world. That's what they're for. Now, I hope you hear me saying I'm not claiming that art somehow will save your soul. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that God uses art to convey his meaning to you, and he's taught you to use art to convey your meaning to one another. Reading great books won't save your soul. Listening to great music won't save your soul. But listening to music and reading those great books will make a larger soul there to be saved. That's what I want to try and tell you. Tonight we're going to get back together, and I'm going to give you some examples of form used in Shakespeare and in the Bible and in Brahms's music. And then tomorrow we'll talk about visual art and musical art. All right? See ya.